I'm Courtney Smith.
And I'm Elise Sharp.
And we are two Shakespeare nerds who decided to make a podcast about our love for Shakespeare.
In this podcast, we will tackle as many dimensions to Shakespeare's plays as we can by looking at the text, examining the historical context in which it was written, and how the text is viewed through modern lenses of feminism, racism, classism, colonialism, nationalism, ableism, all of the isms.
We will discuss how his plays shaped both the past and present, and, as actors, how his plays can be responsibly performed today.
All while trying our best to approach his works without giving in to bardolatry. So, Shakespeare, anyone? Hi, listeners. Elise here to remind you of all the ways you can support the podcast and the work that Courtney and I do. First up, we have a Patreon. Our Patreon patrons receive exclusive bonus content. Every month, we do a roundup of Shakespeare-related content we have found online. We also share Patreon-exclusive bonus episodes of the podcast. These look like extended versions of episodes you've heard here, collaborations with other Shakespeare podcasters, and Courtney and I doing reviews of Shakespeare-adjacent media, like TV shows, movies, and books that are inspired by or loosely based on Shakespeare and Shakespeare plays. Patreon patrons also receive snail mail from the podcast, and some levels even vote on future episodes of our podcast. If you are interested in checking out our Patreon, or just the Shakespeare-related names we've given the tiers of support, head to patreon.com/ShakespeareAnyone. The link is also in our episode description. After you've done that, please rate, review, and follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Your review might even make it on an episode. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and tell a friend. Word of mouth is our best form of advertising. Thank you so much for all of the support you give the podcast. Now, on to the episode.
Welcome to another Shakespeare Anyone mini-episode. In these mini-episodes, we'll be exploring topics that are related to Shakespeare but aren't necessarily connected to whatever play we've been discussing.
And they're mini because, well, they're shorter than our other episodes. They're like quartos if the regular episodes are folio editions.
In today's episode, we'll be talking about Shakespeare's contemporary, Ben Jonson.
While you may or may not be familiar with Ben Jonson or his work, you have probably heard of his plays. We've referenced many of his works in our episodes.
Like Shakespeare, Jonson was a poet, playwright, and actor in London during the late 1500s and early 1600s. Born in London in June 1572, most likely on the 11th, Jonson was 8 years younger than Shakespeare. Jonson's father, a clergyman who claimed descent from Scottish gentry, died shortly before Jonson's birth. His mother later married a bricklayer. Little else is known about Jonson's parents.
Despite the family's working-class status throughout his childhood, Jonson was educated at the prestigious Westminster School at the expense of William Camden, an author and antiquary who was one of the masters and later headmaster of the school, who Jonson studied under and later credited as the source of his art and knowledge. Westminster regularly produced plays in Latin, which would have provided Jonson with an early exposure to the theatrical medium he would later succeed in. Jonson may have later been admitted to St. John's College, Cambridge. However, like Shakespeare, his formal education was cut short. Jonson left school, reportedly unwillingly, to work for his stepfather as a bricklayer.
Jonson was, quote, unable to endure, unquote, the work of a bricklayer, and at some point in the 1590s, he joined the English army as a volunteer and fought in the Netherlands against Spanish troops during the 80 Years' War. Notably, he fought and defeated an enemy challenger in single combat, stripping his opponent of his weapons in an antiquated fashion. According to scholars, this type of combat, quote, was rarely practiced in this period. Jonson's victory would have brought him to the notice of his superior officers, unquote.
Jonson returned to England by 1592, likely with the first group of troops returning home from the 80 Years' War, and was married in 1594 to Anne Lewis. They had several children, Unfortunately, Johnson would end up outliving all of them. Johnson would also later refer to Anne as, quote, a shrew yet honest, unquote. Like William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway, the couple appeared to live separately throughout Johnson's life. The reasons for this separation may have had little to do with the state of their marital relations and may have been more of a practical choice for Johnson's career, or at the insistence of one of his patrons, or due to legal troubles that we'll talk more about later.
In another similarity to Shakespeare, it is unclear when exactly Johnson became involved with the theater scene in London. During his early career, he may have worked as a journeyman performer with a traveling company, where he performed the leading role of Hieronymo in Thomas Kyd's The Spanish Tragedy. Reportedly, Johnson was, quote, never a good actor, but an excellent instructor, unquote. And once he established himself as a writer, Johnson left acting altogether, unlike Shakespeare. During these very early years of his career, Johnson also wrote get-penny plays, which were quickly written, financially motivated plays.
By 1597, he was writing for Philip Henslowe's theater company, the Lord Admiral's Men. He was paid by Henslowe to finish the now-lost satire play Isle of Dogs by Thomas Nash, which was performed later that year at the Swan. For reasons lost to historical record, Isle of Dogs was apparently very offensive to the crown, which led to the Privy Council ordering the closure of all London theaters on July 28, 1597, and the arrest of Ben Johnson along with two fellow actors.
By 1598, Johnson was also associated with The Curtain, and his play, Every Man in His Humor, was performed there that fall by the Lord Chamberlain's Men and featured William Shakespeare and Richard Burbage in leading roles. Likely Burbage played the clever servant Brainworm, while Shakespeare might have played Noel, the father who worries after his son. This play was a turning point in Johnson's career and catapulted him into a new level of success as a playwright.
Shortly after the opening of Every Man in His Humor, and possibly while the play was still in performances, Johnson killed the actor Gabriel Spencer in a duel and was indicted on a charge of manslaughter. During his imprisonment for this crime, Johnson converted to Catholicism. Johnson was sentenced to the gallows, but he escaped a hanging by claiming benefit of the clergy.
Originally established to protect the clergy from receiving corporal punishment during the Middle Ages, when it was difficult to determine who was a clergy member, but few outside the clergy could read Latin, benefit of clergy applicants had to prove they could read a passage from the Latin Bible. As literacy grew, judges allowed convicts convicted of certain felonies to apply for benefit of clergy and use the benefit as more of a flexible test. As judges could determine the difficulty of the reading passage, it allowed them to have a final say over whether or not to sentence convicts to corporal punishment.
As a convict who successfully pleaded the benefit of clergy but who was convicted of manslaughter, Ben Johnson was branded on the thumb with an F for felon. This brand prevented Johnson from being able to plead the benefit of the clergy again should he find himself facing the gallows again. Johnson would continue to have run-ins with the law throughout his career.
Johnson then wrote a sequel to Every Man in His Humor, which was obviously titled Every Man Out of His Humor. This play was first performed in November or December of 1599 by the Lord Chamberlain's Men at the recently opened Globe Theatre. It was an ambitious piece that attempted to be the English equivalent to a Greek comedy by Aristophanes and was the longest play written for the Elizabethan public theater. However, it proved to be a disastrous flop, which led Johnson to leave writing for the public theaters and work instead primarily with private theaters, such as Blackfriars and the Inns of Court, and children's companies, namely the Children of the Queen's Chapel.
During his time writing for the Children of the Queen's Chapel, Johnson became embroiled in a feud that would be known as the War of the Theaters. This feud, between Johnson and fellow playwrights John Marston and Thomas Dekker, was fueled by Johnson reacting, perhaps oversensitively, to a depiction of himself in a play of Marston's. Johnson retaliated in his play Poetaster, depicting himself favorably alongside unfavorable caricatures of Marston and Dekker. Dekker then counterattacked in his play Satyromastix, depicting Johnson as a, quote, self-promoting, self-creating figure, shooting his quills like a porcupine and flicking ink in every man's face, unquote.
Scholars now suggest that this War of the Theaters may have been, at least in part, contrived as a kind of early modern cross-promotion that elevated the careers of all three playwrights and their respective companies. Indeed, before, during, and after the quote-unquote feud, the theater companies continuously shared actors and playwrights, and Johnson would later collaborate with both Marston and Decker. In other words, the feud may have just been an elaborate marketing stunt.
Johnson produced a prolific amount of writing upon the ascension of King James I, including speeches for 3 out of the 8 pageants that were performed for the royal entry to the City of London in March 1604, and multiple masks. It appears that he may have caught the attention of the royals because of a mask entitled Entertainment at Althorpe, which was performed in the summer of 1603 for the entertainment of Queen Anne and Prince Henry on their journey from Edinburgh to London.
After James I's ascension to the throne, Johnson continued to write for court masks, and would throughout the rest of his career. His collaborations with set designer Inigo Jones would eventually define the Jacobean-era masks. For more on masks, check out our Twelfth Night episode on plays for the court. Johnson introduced new aspects to the mask form, including expanding the spoken portions of the mask to create more of a dramatic text, creating the concept of a dramatic action or a through line that ran through the evening's entertainment, new motives for the arrivals of characters, and a sort of pre-show opening act that became known as the anti-mask.
Even though he had become a royal favorite in the first decade of James's reign, Johnson still found himself in trouble with authorities. He was thrown out of the audience of a court mask, not one he wrote. He made enemies of courtiers and was brought before the Privy Council on charges of popery and treason after a production of Johnson's play Sejanus His Fall in early 1604. And he was imprisoned again in 1605 for content that the court found offensive after the first performances of his play Eastward Ho, which was written in collaboration with John Marston and George Chapman.
After his release from prison in 1605, Johnson attended a dinner party in early October. Among the other guests were many of the leading conspirators in the gunpowder plot, including Robert Catesby and Francis Thresham. While Johnson's involvement in the plot is ambiguous, it certainly would have been in its final stages of preparation. For more on the gunpowder plot, check out our mini-episode on the gunpowder plot. After the discovery of the gunpowder plot, Johnson wrote a congratulatory poem to Lord Monteagle, who raised the alarm that foiled the plot. He called Lord Monteagle the savior of the nation and agreed to help Robert Cecil with the investigation of the conspiracy. Johnson also wrote to Cecil and suggested that the revelation of the conspiracy would convince many Catholics to convert to Protestantism. This is interesting because, remember, Johnson had recently converted to Catholicism.
However, Johnson was not one of those Catholics. And in 1606, he and his wife Anne were brought before the consistory court to explain why they hadn't been showing up to Anglican services. Johnson claimed that his wife was innocent of this charge and vouched for her piety, but admitted that he had not received communion due to his own religious scruples. The couple was required to return to court at a later date to produce future proof that they had received communion. Johnson was further ordered to receive religious counseling from prominent figures in the church in the hopes of overcoming this scruple. During the 6 years between his court date and his return to the Church of England, Johnson wrote some of his more famous and popular comedies, including Volpone or the Fox, Epicene or the Silent Woman, and The Alchemist.
In 1612, Johnson became the tutor to Sir Walter Raleigh's son and traveled with the quote-unquote knavishly inclined Raleigh Jr. to France and the Netherlands. Johnson returned to England by June 29, 1613, as he would later imply in his poem, An Execration Upon Vulcan, that he saw the Globe Theatre burn on the day that the cannon in Henry VIII misfired and ignited the thatched roof.
Prior to his trip with Raleigh Jr., he had begun to collect his writings from the previous 2 decades with an eye towards eventual publication. In May 1612, a book entitled Ben Jonson, His Epigrams, was entered into the stationer's register. No copies survive. However, a contemporary did write about reading the book, so this collection, presumably of manuscripts, was published.
In November 1616, a printer named William Stansby published The Works of Benjamin Johnson, a folio edition of Johnson's collected works. Johnson worked closely on the production of the works, though he likely did not have complete control over its printing and production. Contemporary observers were bemused by Johnson's decision to include 9 plays within the works, as the title promised more serious fare. At the time, plays were seen more as pop culture ephemera rather than literature worthy of print publication, especially in a folio edition alongside poems, epigrams, and court masks. However, with this publication, Johnson, quote, created a notion of authorial ownership and identity that is recognizably modern, unquote, over his plays, which had otherwise belonged to their theaters. The works would serve as a blueprint for other collected works of playwrights that would be printed later in the century, especially in 1623.
The publication of the works in 1616, the same year as Shakespeare's death, cemented Johnson as the premier living author in England. In February of 1616, Johnson was awarded a royal pension, which established him as Britain's poet laureate. And it was at this point in his life, his late 40s, when Johnson decided to leave London and walk to Edinburgh and back. During this trip, he stayed with William Drummond at Hawthornden Castle, whose private notes on their conversations during Johnson's stay were later published and, quote, vividly record Johnson's literary opinions and ambitions, his jokes, dreams, and personal reminiscences, along with much social gossip, unquote. Drummond also wrote an evaluation of Johnson's personality. Quote, he is a great lover and praiser of himself, a condemner and scorner of others, given rather to lose a friend than a jest, jealous of every word and action of those about him, especially after drink, which is one of the elements in which he liveth. Unquote.
Johnson returned to London in 1619, and later that year, he was conferred an honorary degree from Oxford. He began an era of quiet scholarship, was reportedly almost knighted, and was given a patent to become the Master of the Revels if the current Master of Revels and the next runner-up both died before Johnson. He continued to write court masks every year through the end of King James's life, except for 1619, when he was on his long walk.
In the mid to late 1620s, Johnson's health was on the decline. He appears to have suffered a paralytic stroke in late 1627 or early 1628, and was affected by a quote-unquote palsy, possibly Parkinson's disease. His health conditions were compounded by poverty. Despite his pension and other grants from noble patrons, Johnson's lifestyle was one of overspending and living beyond his income.
Despite his difficulties with health and money, Johnson continued to produce work, especially court masks. His final court masks were performed in 1631. His works during the final years of his life draw, quote, imaginatively on northern traditions, including the stories of Robin Hood, and memories of his own Scottish journey many years earlier, unquote, in stark contrast to the city plays of his early career. Theatrical success continued to evade Johnson, as none of these later plays proved successful.
Johnson died in mid-August 1637. He was buried in Westminster Abbey, and his funeral was attended by most of the area's nobility and gentry. A volume of memorial poems written by his Oxford friends was published in 1638, and a second folio edition of Johnson's works was published in 1640 through 1641, with additional volumes containing his later plays and previously unpublished masks, plays, and other works.
He is remembered for his technically perfect and sharply contemporary comedies, and as a writer of literary distinction who was considered by contemporaries to be equal to, or perhaps even better than, Shakespeare. And his influence can be seen in Restoration comedies. One of his greatest contributions is perhaps the idea of authorial ownership for playwrights, and that plays were worthy of folio publication. Without his decision to gather and publish his own work, we might not ever have gotten the first folio of the works of William Shakespeare.
Does that mean this podcast might not exist without Ben Johnson?
Yeah, I think that's what that means.
Or Shakespeare wouldn't have become as prominent because we would have lost more, if not all, of his works to time.
And then maybe we'd be doing a podcast called Johnson Anyone? Which sounds...
Okay, we've gotten off track. Back to the first folio of William Shakespeare. Johnson wrote two poems for the front material of the first folio. The first, entitled To the Reader, which appears opposite the title page featuring the Druschout engraving of Shakespeare, reads, quote, "This figure that thou here seest put, it was for gentle Shakespeare cut, wherein the graver had a strife with nature to outdo the life. Oh, could he but have drawn his wit as well in brass as he hath hit his face, the print would then surpass all that ever was in brass. But, since he cannot, reader, look not on his picture, but his book." Unquote.
The second, entitled To the Memory of My Beloved, the author Mr. William Shakespeare reads, "To draw no envy, Shakespeare, on thy name, am I thus ample to thy book and fame. Well, I confess thy writings to be such as neither man nor muse can praise too much. 'Tis true, and all men's suffrage. But these ways were not the paths I meant unto thy praise. For sealiest ignorance on these may light, which, when it sounds at best, but echoes right. Or blind affection, which doth ne'er advance the truth, but gropes and urgeth all by chance. Or crafty malice might pretend this praise, and think to ruin where it seemed to raise."
These are as some infamous bawd or whore should praise a matron. What could hurt her more? But thou art proof against them, and indeed, above the ill fortune of them or the need. I therefore will begin. Soul of the age, the applause, delight, and wonder of our stage. My Shakespeare, rise. I will not lodge thee by Chaucer or Spenser, or bid Beaumont lie a little further to make thee a room. Thou art a monument without a tomb, and art alive still while thy book doth live, and we have wits to read and praise to give.
That I not mix thee so, my brain excuses, I mean with great but disproportioned muses. For if I thought my judgment were of years, I should commit thee surely with thy peers, and tell how far thou didst our Lily outshine, or sporting kid, or Marlowe's mighty line. And though thou hadst small Latin and less Greek, from thence to honor thee, I would not seek for names, but call forth thundering Aeschylus, Euripides, and Sophocles to us, Pacuvius, Axius, him of Cordova dead, to life again, to hear thy buskin tread and shake a stage, or when thy socks were on, leave thee alone for the comparison of all that insolent Greece or haughty Rome sent forth, or since did from their ashes come. Triumph, my Britain, thou hast one to show to whom all scenes of Europe homage owe."
He was not of an age but for all time, and all the muses still were in their prime when, like Apollo, he came forth to warm our ears, or like a Mercury to charm. Nature herself was proud of his designs, and joyed to wear the dressing of his lines, which were so richly spun and woven so fit, as since she will vouchsafe no other wit. The merry Greek, tart Aristophanes, neat Terence, witty Plautus, now not please, but antiquated and deserted lie, as they were not of nature's family.
Yet must I not give nature all? Thy art, my gentle Shakespeare, must enjoy a part. For though the poet's matter nature be, his art doth give the fashion, and that he, who casts to write a living line, must sweat, such as thine are, and strike the second heat upon the muse's anvil, turn the same, and himself with it, what he thinks to frame, or, for the laurel, he may gain a scorn. For a good poet's made as well as born, and such wert thou. Look how the father's face lives in his issue. Even so the race of Shakespeare's mind and manners brightly shines in his well-turned and true-filed lines, in each of which he seems to shake a lance as brandished at the eyes of ignorance.
Sweet swan of Avon, what a sight it were to see thee in our waters yet appear and make those flights upon the banks of Thames that so did take Eliza and our James. But stay, I see thee in the hemisphere advanced, and made a constellation there. Shine forth, thou star of poets, and with rage or influence chide or cheer the drooping stage, which, since thy flight from hence hath mourned like night, and despairs day but for thy volume's light.
And that's Ben Johnson.
Thank you for listening to this episode.
I'm Courtney Smith.
And I'm Elise Sharp.
This is Shakespeare Anyone?
Thank you so much for listening to Shakespeare Anyone. Works referenced in this episode are available in the episode description. Our theme music is Never Ending Minute by Sounds Like Sander. If you would like to support us, it would help us out if you would hit the subscribe button, like us, leave a comment, write a review, share us on social media, tell a friend about us, all the things. We'd appreciate it.
You can also support the podcast at patreon.com/ShakespeareAnyone.
Patreon patrons get access to exclusive bonus content throughout the year. The link is also in the episode description.
For more, you can visit our website, ShakespeareAnyone.com, follow us on Instagram at ShakespeareAnyonePod, or Twitter at ShakespeareAnyone. For Twitter, that's Shakespeare, Any, and the number one. Every other platform is spelled out like the name of the podcast.
Now, because you listened all the way to the end of the credits, here's a completely random Shakespeare quote for you.
From Hamlet, Act 2, Scene 2, spoken by Polonius. Brevity is the soul of wit.